At this time, I'm going to bring somebody who's named Danny M. up to introduce our speaker tonight, our opening speaker. So nothing further. I give you Danny from Philly.
Hi, everybody. Recovering addict named Danny.
Hey.
I got the honor of introducing Jim tonight. I met Jim in Florida, and a lot of people know the basis of NA history, and what intrigued me about Jim was he knew a lot of details, and I think it's important that we learn about the details of Narcotics Anonymous. Now, I don't know if he's going to talk about the details or not tonight, but I know he has a lot of information that enlightened me, and I was definitely intrigued by it. So I recommended that he speak here tonight, and I know he's got a clean, clear message in Narcotics Anonymous, which I like that automatically. So with that, I'll give you Jim.
I'm an addict. My name's Jim.
Hey,
I really need that. There's a lot of things people can accuse me of, one of which is not being too soft when I speak. So usually you can hear me in the back of the room without a microphone. I was 11 years old, and I was sleeping in a culvert pipe in Rahway Park, New Jersey. And I was afraid to go home because the old man was lit up. That was a line from the very first fourth step that I wrote, probably at the ripe old age of maybe 14. I grew up in a house with an addictive father. My father was an Irish immigrant, and I was born when he was 50, so I grew up with a different generation's morals, a different generation's ideas. It was something that separated me from my peers. I was an overly intelligent child, so much so that I was one of those kids that skipped the third grade because I was exasperating the nuns and the priests that were teaching me to the point where they just didn't want to deal with me. We were joking about this the other night. They would send notes home about what I was doing, and I would correct the notes, you know, when my mother would sign them and send them back. Sister Kenneth misspelled this. But that was the things that separated me. I was a different child just from that concept. I was a different kid. I didn't fit in. When I was young, in that same neighborhood of maybe 9 or 10 years old, they started me with this process of if I took this little pill in the morning, I didn't think quite as much. I wasn't as fast as I was. It was a miracle for kids like me that were just a little bit too ahead of everybody else. And I started to develop this ideology that if I took something, I felt like everybody else did. Or at least it looked like I felt like what everybody else looked like they felt like. When that process started to repeat itself, it became natural for me. And it was the way that I learned it. And it was just how I learned to live. I realized that if I put something in my body, I didn't feel different. I go back to the culvert pipe. Now, I didn't miss school because, you know, I was kind of one of them brainy kids, so I enjoyed school. And yet I still managed to sit there on the bus and tell myself, well, you know, the other kids didn't get to camp out last night, and separate myself from them even further. I did not appreciate and I did not delve into the stuff my father did. My father fought a very long battle, you know, with his demons. And, You know, in the things that separated me from my peers, all of my peers, that, you know, all of my mates in school, their dads went and fought in Vietnam. My dad fought in the Second World War. This is a totally different generation. And I learned to bottle a lot of those feelings away. A lot of those guys came back, you know, from the Pacific and from, you know, Europe. Did. You know, I wasn't that old of a kid, you know. And I learned those lessons well, really well. So here I am at 11 years old under a bridge thinking this is a normal thing. You know, I go home, take a shower, change clothes, do work, schoolwork, whatever, and then I'm back out doing what I'm doing. I had a lot of talents, and anything I set my mind into, I could excel at. I learned that obsessive and compulsive behavior really early on. If I wanted to learn a skill, I could learn the skill. I had that kind of focus. My mother had me raised in the arts, so I excelled at music. And as I got through this process of dealing with this, there was an intervention in my family's life. I had a family friend who, when I was about 12, took my mother and I one night to a church basement. And there were other people. There were other adults. And there were kids my age. And they all had one thing in common, which was this addiction in their family. And I started to realize that they had a program that they were living and that they were working in their lives. There I am, 12 years old, sitting in a church basement talking about 12-step recovery with other kids that are 12 and 13 years old, hearing the horrors of what went on. I started at that point to have this split personality or this split identity of the fact that it made me feel good to talk to these people. It made me feel good to understand. When I went to this meeting, there were four of these meetings in the state of New Jersey. In 1990, when I stopped going to those meetings as an adult on a regular basis, there were almost 200 of them in the state of New Jersey. So the idea that I'm drawn to the history of Narcotics Anonymous became a natural progression, and we'll talk, and I'll get into that as I go on. But I understood that, you know, the more there was of this, the more I recovered. I felt better going through these steps. I wasn't afraid of it. I also started experimenting the same way that we all do when we were teenagers. You know, and some of us even younger. The problem was, is these people were my peers now. And so you would put a whole room full of us together, and we'd hang out together. Nobody in the room told us, hey, by the way, you guys are going to be a little bit more susceptible to this. You know, use the buddy system. None of us had a clue about how to put, you know, something down until it was empty. You know, or push a plate away until it was clean. So when the normal patterns developed in my life, I didn't have people who didn't have addiction in their lives there with me. Now, I don't fault them, because I guarantee today, I know, going back and dealing and making amends with some of the people that were adults then, that were bringing me through these things, yeah, they talked about it. We just didn't listen. Adolescence, I don't know what. The things that I excelled at, I still got great grades in school. I played music. I played music really well. I could make money playing music and enjoyed the lifestyle of being a long-haired musician. I enjoyed it so much to the point where at 15 and 16 years old, I was making more money in a single night than my friends would all month long at McDonald's or wherever else they were working. And I could do the things that money brought me when you're 15 and 16 years old. You know, my best mate and I in high school, we had a 70 Hemi Cuda, which we paid for in cash. And that lifestyle, and it's not about the drug-a-logs, but that lifestyle was appealing to me. But at the same time, I still had this recovery thing. So I had this split lifestyle going on. I felt good when I'd go to one of these meetings. But I could also feel dirty when I wanted to out in the clubs. And there was nobody holding me accountable. There was nothing holding me accountable. As my life progressed and as I got further and further along, these two identities started to meet each other. And sometimes, and I know nobody else has ever had this idea where you have different, you compartmentalize your life and you never want to see this person from this part of your life meet this person from this part of your life. But that started to happen more and more often. I had grown up and I had become an adult and still kept, you know, with this 12-step recovery thing. And had the charge of other people's children. And that took me to places. We wrote literature at that point, too. My story's in their book. And we wrote a book in 1984. My story's in their book. I feel good today knowing that even though it wasn't intentional, I was able to help people then, people my age. My disease took me to dark places, too, at the same time. I would go through these binge and purges. And it really became this blurry period. And I've been going back to old friends trying to reconstruct some of this stuff 25 years later. But my last run of using ended in Atlanta, Georgia. I had spent about 10.5 weeks out on the road with a touring band. And I spent some time in the islands recording with another musician and went to Atlanta to blow off a little steam. And with one of these guys that I had kind of come through that program with. And I woke up in a hotel room with a room full of strippers, people passed out, works and paraphernalia all over the room. And I had to wake my buddy up in the corner and ask him if we'd been having a good time. And 2 weeks of my life were just gone. I had no clue. And I started realizing then that I was losing gaps and periods of time in my life, weeks at a time. I was terrified that, you know, had I done something, you know? And you live with that thought of, you know, did I kill somebody? Did I steal something? What did I do? I mean, it's one thing to deal with the guilt of what I knew I did, but I had no freaking clue. So I went through a purge. I went through one of these periods of becoming one of those self-righteous bastards who said, oh, I can go and, you know, have this clean lifestyle again. And I went and I took these kids that I was responsible for to a conference in North Carolina. And I had a really good friend that had gone and moved to North Carolina. And he says, you need to come down here. You'll find a beautiful blonde and you will never go home. And so, you know, I took these kids I was responsible for and pull into the parking lot, and I'm standing there, and it's like, it's one of those things like from a movie where like everything stops and it's in slow motion, and you hear that kind of music in the background, and here comes this like stunning blonde walking across the parking lot, the hair is blowing, you know that? And I sounded good. I looked good. I mean, you know, it's kind of weird to believe, but yeah, I was like thin and good looking with long hair. I just have long hair, as much of it as I can keep now. And I hit it off with this lady, because we both had recovery in common. And my disease kicked in because I wanted this. This was a shiny trinket. But there was something different about this lady. And I started spending time with her when I came back to North Carolina. And I started going to meetings with her. Now, understand, during these 10 years that I had been growing up with these kids, and I have no problem in saying this, and if the word Alcoholics Anonymous bothers someone, call your sponsor, not mine. I went to see the great speakers of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as kids, for us to learn that program, we went to hear these people speak. And I'd pick these lines up. I'd hear these things, and it sounded good, and you repeat it in a meeting, and people go, oh, that sounds good. And this lady I'd met, who had, you know, kids that she was responsible for, she was an addict. She'd been clean a couple of years. So when she said to me, "Hey, you want to come? I'm going to go to a meeting tonight. You want to come?" There was no difference to me. I mean, you know, it's all the 12 steps on a wall. It really didn't matter to me. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, this is really kind of uncomfortable. And we started going to a couple of these meetings, and there was an old man, and I say that very carefully because I'm about as old today as he was then. But he started talking about me, and he talked about blackouts, and he talked about this stuff. And I jacked him up in the corner one night, and I said, "Old man, what the hell is your problem?" He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "You know, I'm here with my lady, you know, I'm just kind of a visitor, and you're like pulling my stuff all over the place. So what is up with that? I mean, is this how you treat folks?" And he turns to me and he says, "If you're identifying, have you ever thought about maybe thinking about why you're identifying with what I'm saying?" And in 10 years of denial, it had never occurred to me, holy cow, I might have this thing. But of course, the denial was still there. That can't be that bad. I'll just stay in this purge, clean up my stuff. I'll cut it back a little. It'll be fine. Well, this lady had been married, and she had kids, two wonderful, well-behaved, well-mannered children. And she had been married to a Marine, a very big, strong, Marine-like Marine, who had been clean one day less than her, which she pointed out on a regular basis. And he was getting bothered that I was sitting in his damn meetings. "You're just a visitor. What the hell are you doing here? Why don't you go back to your own damn meetings? This is how I stay clean." And it kind of came to a head one night. And I wish I had one of those stories where my deciding to pick up a white chip was one of those things where I pulled myself out of a grave and crawled through the gutter and there was a dime or 50 cents and I called the hotline and, you know, I've been clean since. He decided to pick me up after a meeting and throw me around a parking lot like a broken kite. And he threw me over a car, I kid you not, and he said, "You don't have the right to be here." And I stood up and I said, "It says in the readings that we don't care how much or who your connections were, what you want to do about your problem is all we're interested in." And he says, "I don't really see your motivation." And I walked back inside. And we used to do something where we would take a white chip, and they were actually chips that we'd drill holes in. And we'd hang it on the coffee pot. If you had a second thought after the meeting, you could come back in and get that chip. And I did that. And the chairperson was still sitting there. He gave me a hug. And that was the 2nd of August, 1990. And it has not been necessary for me to return to that process since then. And I started looking at the reality of what I had done in my life. I looked at the reality that I thought it was perfectly normal that when it was 105 degrees out, that everybody else should be wearing long sleeve shirts in the middle of the summer. And I started going to meetings, and I identified myself as an addict, and it felt good. It felt right. And I started to shun that 10 years of experience before me because I sounded so good, and I was dangerous. I could hurt people in meetings because I sounded good. I looked good, you know, and I could hurt people with it. And the first 30 days I spent in North Carolina were nice, and people wanted to know what I thought. They wanted to hear what I had to think. They wanted to know what I thought about the second step. And I left, and I made the decision to go back and finish my degree back in New Jersey. And the rest of my story and my talk really involves my recovery. I make that point of talking about the, you know, waking up in a hotel room with a set of works. My higher power has a strange sense of humor. I work in the coffee industry today, and I taste cup coffee on a daily basis. So today, I have a constant reminder because I have to hold a silver spoon in my hand at least half a dozen times every day, and I have to take care of my little silver spoon. So I am never more than that far away from the fact of reminding me that I didn't have that glorious of an entry into our fellowship. I left North Carolina and went back to school with about 35 days clean. And having grown up in Jersey, I was not expecting culture shock the way I got it. So these meetings were 60 minutes in North Carolina, and everybody was friendly, and you know, you hugged each other. And during that first year or first month there, we had just started a sixth meeting in Winston-Salem. So there was this parallel. It was like, wow, there's six meetings. And I was thinking about this feeling I had. And I went back to Jersey, and the first meeting I went to in New Jersey was in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And meetings were a little different. They were 90 minutes long. If you didn't have a year or more clean, you didn't share in the meeting for the first 60 minutes. Because you didn't have any experience, strength, and hope to share. You were only going to spread your disease. That pissed me off. After the 60-minute mark, you would be able to, which was ironic, because after the 60-minute mark, you'd have a secretary's report and a treasurer's report, and then a smoke break, which was funny because we smoked in the meetings anyway. And I never had anybody tell me to sit down and shut up because I never had the balls to stand up and speak in those first 60 minutes because it said right in the opening, if you have a year or less, we ask you to please listen and get with someone after the meeting. This teaches you a valuable lesson here in Narcotics Anonymous, the lesson of listening. You can only stay clean by giving back what was freely given to you, but first you have to have someone give it to you. So after the 60-minute mark, you could ask the question. How you did that was you would stand up, you'd give your clean date, which was embarrassing, and you'd say, I'm an addict, my name is Jim, my clean date is 2 August 1990, and I'm having a little bit of trouble with powerlessness, so can one of the members please share a little with me? And you'd sit the hell back down. I noticed something. The meeting tended to be a little fuller after the 60-minute mark than it did before. And it took me a while to figure that out, that was because the members realized it was more important for them to be there to give back. And if they were even working late, they would always make it for that last 30 minutes. Now, I was cocky, but at the same time, I was terrified because I knew what was going to happen to me. You know, I talked about the Marine throwing me around the parking lot like a broken kite. He and I are so closely aligned and so similar that it was watching me 20 years down the road, clean with untreated addiction, which was terrifying. Just terrifying. Today, through the magic of recovery, that man and I are good friends. We have family events, which I welcome. So I was terrified, and I couldn't figure out how to get rid of this ego thing I had, this thought in my head of like, you know, you got all this damn experience, but you only got 35 days clean, you know, and you can't say anything in a meeting. And I went to a meeting down in Long Beach Island or somewhere further down the shore, and I lived on the shore, so saying down the shore meant you went further. And they were podium meetings, so you'd stand up at the podium if you wanted to share. You had to like, get up out of your seat and come up here if you were an older member. And I went to a meeting one night, and one of the questions was, why do you keep coming back? And there was a man named Dutch there. And when you were new, you'd kind of like all congregate in the back, and you'd sit back there. And he came up, and he was kind of this angry guy. And he said, I keep coming back to these meetings because I don't want to be like that miserable piece of shit sitting back there, fucking dying on the inside. Didn't point right at me, but he was talking about me, looking right at me, and I was afraid. I was afraid of this man, and he's not a big dude, but I was afraid of this guy. And I realized that I needed to really apply myself to this because I was going to die. I was going to wake up in a hotel room, have done something stupid, or they were going to find me dead in a hotel room. One of these guys I'd grown up with was a clean addict. And I needed a sponsor. And I called him and we started going to meetings together. And he says, we're going to talk about the steps. And that's what we're going to do is we're going to work the steps. And he gave me my introduction to Narcotics Anonymous and understanding what the difference was. And he says, tell me about the first step. And he says, I'm powerless over dope and my life is screwed up. He says, tell me where it says dope. I'm being powerless over addiction, dope, it's all the same thing. He says, no. And he did this, and I've done this for a lot of years since then. He says, you're not powerless over dope. Nobody in this room is powerless over dope. Not powerless over heroin. Nothing ever cooked itself up and shot itself in my arm. No substance ever formed smoke and forced its smoke down my lungs. No pills ever jumped out of the cabinet and raped me. I was always a willing participant in this process. So being powerless over the dope is like being powerless over this book. I can throw that book out there 100 times. Now, the disease of addiction is like the gravity. Every single time I throw the book out there, it's going to hit the ground. I understood that. I needed to see something tangible. We used to put a chair in the middle of the room, an empty chair, because it represented the addict that was going to die that night. Not that could, there wasn't that soft passing by. The light is on in the attic. No, someone was going to die tonight, and that chair was for the person who was going to die. I needed to focus on that because I couldn't think about anybody but myself. So understanding that the book hit the ground and the gravity, I got that. I understood that concept, that it wasn't about the dope. I am so grateful that I have not ever needed to focus on just the dope. However, applying that into my life and realizing that when, you know, you sit down the spoon and you pick up the fork, I've kind of grown a whole person since I've been here, you know? Our disease manifests into just about anything we allow it to. Anything that feels good. Oh, don't even talk to me. Your little 34 pants. But I understood the idea that it manifested in any area of my life. I had a great education. I had a fabulous education. I had a parochial education. Never had the faith. I was one of those kids that sat in mass. When I say a parochial education, I went to a Catholic high school. I have to say that, or a Catholic school for 11 years, because where I live in the South now, when I say parochial, they don't really understand that. I wonder if that's an amends thing. Anyway, it made me feel different. You know, I would sit in mass every morning learning this awful language that no one spoke. But I would sit and I'd watch these kids sitting next to me just filled with whatever they were filled with. And I never felt that. And I always felt different for that. Many years later, I went back to make amends to one of the priests that I had tortured throughout my educational career. And he told me, he says, you know, once in a generation, a student comes along that doesn't belong to you. And he said, you were that student. I said, that could have been something you could have told me 20 years ago. I really could have used that information. But he also told me, he says, you can't be mad at God and not believe in God at the same time, because I had absolutely no anger. I was okay with that, you know. When I got to that second step part with my sponsor, I was struggling because I said, came to believe that a power greater than myself. And I said, I don't believe in a power greater than myself. I don't have this vision of the little invisible man throwing lightning bolts out of the sky. And he said, tell me where it says God. Power greater than yourself. It's all the same thing. And he made me do something. He made me write out this quote, and those of you that like cool Narcotics Anonymous quotes, this is one of them. He said, you want to write out, a power greater than yourself is anything that makes you stop and see the insanity of the situation you're in and forces you to accept the fact that you're not going to control the outcome of that situation. And he made me write it out and put it on my steering wheel, which was odd because he had never driven with me. I went to meetings and I would stand up and I would ask for power greater than myself input at the 60-minute mark, to the point where people, I would stand up and clear my throat and people would roll their eyes. I was stuck on this. In Jersey, the only place that you have tandem tractor trailers are South Jersey, like past exit 4 and south. I don't know about anybody else, but I used to have anger issues with driving. Some people do, some don't. In New Jersey, most cars come with a handgun. And a guy on, I had a big old Catalina kind of car, and on the turnpike, this guy in a little RX-7 cut me off. Most people would hit that brake and, you know, let them go. And I hit the accelerator and went after him because I had a 400 cubic inch engine. We're doing 60, 70, 80, 90. If the crowd is really big, we get up to like 120. And we come up over the hill, and there's a tandem tractor trailer coming into my lane. He had made it past. The tractor trailer didn't see me. I locked my brakes up. I'm going sideways. Round, I go up and down the scree slope, I see the traffic coming towards me, back and around, spin around. I'm sitting on the side of the road, nothing hits me. I'm very grateful for the fact that I had put on clean underwear that morning. I'm sitting there, I'm not bleeding, nothing got hit, and I look at my steering wheel and it says, a power greater than yourself is anything that makes you stop. See the insanity of the situation you're in and forces you to accept the fact that you're not going to control the outcome of that situation. I pulled up on the turnpike. We used to have these things, and those of you that are younger, we used to have these, they were like cell phones, but they hung on poles, and you put money in them, and you could make a phone call. And I called my sponsor, and I told him what had happened. He says, do you understand how that applies to your life and your recovery? And I said, yeah. I get it. I said, this, I get it. I said, are they all going to be this painful? He said, that depends on you. And then he explained to me, he said, you know, we're going to talk about the third step, and you got to understand, you got to be willing to understand the concept of us using the word God as we understood him. And he made it very clear to me that I did not need to understand God or higher power to understand power greater than myself, because a power greater than myself were the tools that my higher power worked with. I didn't need to believe in the hammer to hear or see the hammer drive the nail into the wall. I didn't need to believe in it because it was right there. I saw the hammer. There was no doubting that that's a hammer. Now, if the hammer is hammering something into the wall by itself, well, means I've probably relapsed and the book's floating in the air, but I had to understand the idea that there was things being put in my life that I was not going to be able to explain away. I really struggled with the God as we understand him thing. Again, that whole thing of I can't be mad at God and not believe in God at the same time. How do I do that? And at the end of my educational career, I was living in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and I had written my thesis paper for my degree. And we used to type them. And again, for those of you that are young, a typewriter was kind of like a word processor, but instead of having it go through a computer, when you hit the key, it actually put the word right on the paper. And if you wanted more than one copy, you needed carbon paper, and you'll need to grab one of the older folks to explain that to you later. Early on, when I was talking about the fact of having a mother who was artistic, when I went to my first year of school, my mother sent me to school with 2 500-count bottles of Valium so that I could relax after studies. This made me very popular. It also meant I relaxed a lot. Also, I had all sorts of foods. One of the things I had was I had a cat at the time, and she also sent me to school with tuna fish. So I had one of these little 6.5-ounce cans. Somewhere along the line, first year of school, I lost the label. So I started crushing cigarette butts out on it. So by the end of the year, I really didn't quite want to know what was in the can anymore. Could be cat food, could be tuna. Really didn't need the surprise. But I kept it as a paperweight. My sponsor and I had been at a meeting. Third step was the topic. As we're driving to the meeting, there's a big squall that blows up, which when you live on the water is like one of these unpredictable, the weatherman didn't tell you about storms. I'm freaking out during the meeting. My thesis is sitting there. My apartment is wide open. Finally, we don't go to the diner. We go back to my apartment. My apartment is blown all over the place. During the meeting, the guy kept going on with this mantra of, you don't need to understand your higher power. You just need to know that it's there and it works. We get back to my apartment, and I'm thinking about, it's there and it works. My sponsor walks over. My apartment is everywhere. He picks up this little 6.5-ounce can, and he picks up my thesis paper. He says, all you need to know is that it's there, and it works. I don't have to explain what my higher power is to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. If there's one quality that I know that a higher power does not have, it's vanity. If anybody ever jacks you up in the corner and tells you you have the wrong God, tell them they have the wrong program. The flip side of that coin is that no one has the right to introduce their higher power to you in a meeting and force it down your throat either. And I started getting a little bitchy with these things, and this is kind of where I changed it to some different gears. I started getting a little weird with that concept because it took me so much to understand that. It was so personal. And I'd sit in meetings and I'd listen to people. My higher power, check me out, whom I choose to call. Man, I don't care what you choose to call your higher power. My higher power, whom I choose to call daily, is all that really matters. The important part of that is tell me how you built that relationship. That's what I need to know about. I don't need to know the name. Because when I hear you give your higher power's name, I go, damn, I got the wrong one again. I wrote an inventory. I carried it with me. Little black marble notebook. And, because Sister Catherine worked hard, a fountain pen. I guarded it. I wrote it. I realized that the fifth step was the priming of the well. Or my fourth step was the priming of the well, and the fifth step was where that stuff started to come out. I wrote more in my little black marble notebook after my fifth step than I did writing the fourth step. I talked to my sponsor more about the material in the little black marble notebook than I did during my fifth step. I had to get all these character defects right. It had to be correct. 20 years later, I had this real revelation. Looking at lists of defects that people put on the wall in clubhouses and seeing all the books on defects of character. What if the only real defect of character is fear? I can boil any defect of character down in some way, shape, or form to fear. Every one of them. In the same way that the second step was my higher power putting tools into my life for me to concentrate on. I saw the hammer. I didn't need to see the gravity of the hammer coming through the air and hitting the wall. the defects of character were represented in my life by shortcomings, me acting out on those defects of character. And it all came down to some form of fear. And I started noticing this pattern, and I see people struggle a lot with, you know, the defects of character and working on your defects of character. If you're going to work on your defects of character, buy them a wedding ring. You're going to be married to them for a really long time. Surrender that. I was worried about making a list and making amends. Everybody hates amends. We're all really good at saying we're sorry. And one of the key things that a man told me very early on was that I had to write out all of the words. I started writing out a list of every word in the step. And I would write out my definition of what it meant. And then on the other side of the page, I would go and I'd look it up in a dictionary. And we talked about the differences of what I thought, and I was well educated, what I thought a word meant and what it actually meant. And my sponsor pointed out to me that this is a disease of perception. And I don't care how smart or how uneducated you are, we all have the same disease of perception. When I went to go into the 8-step process, I told my sponsor I wasn't willing to make amends to some people. And he said, it doesn't say that. It says we made a list and became willing. I said, all right. I made my list. And I brought him my list and we talked about it. I said, here's the list, but I'm still not willing. He said, yes, you are, or you wouldn't have made the list. And I found out there was a little dope fiending going on in the steps at that point. Usually when someone stands up and speaks, they have this very clear-cut point on everything. My views are changing on the 9th step. For the longest period of time, I really believe that the line about unless one to do so would injure them or others, that we were part of the others. Because I fell into that line of you don't go up to the police station and say, hey, you know those 8 robberies that you never solved? But I'm clean and I'm sorry. That works for that part of the amends process in the unless one to do so would injure them or others. If making the amends is going to hurt us because the process of making the amends is painful to us, that doesn't count. Amends and the whole process helps other people deal with anger and it helps us deal with guilt. And we're not responsible for how someone else responds to it. And if they're angry with us and they say things that are hurtful, we've earned that. We're getting help with the guilt, and sometimes we need people to be angry at us. We've done horrible things. I've done bad things. And the response of making amends, as I got into that process with the 10th step and understanding that, where we go through the whole promptly admit it thing. It doesn't say anywhere in the step, and when we were wrong, promptly said we're sorry. It says promptly admitted it. I don't have to go to somebody else. I don't have to call my sponsor and say, well, I yelled at someone today. I have to admit it. None of this stuff matters. My friend Gordon makes a very great point. You know, I'm the most important son of a bitch in the meeting most of the days. Reason is, it's because if I get loaded, I don't really care if the rest of you are clean. It's about me. I'm the one who puts my head on the pillow with me at night. My disease talks to me in the voice I am most likely to listen to, my own. So the amends process has to start with me. I could only go so far with that. I struggled with things like, how do you make amends to society? Yes, you live a certain way. But what about those people at harm? Random faceless people. How do I make amends to those people? I do something. You're more than welcome to steal this. When I go to the bank today, or when I go to the post office, I hold the door open for people. I take an extra 60 seconds Sometimes it freaks them out, especially in the bank. And I hold the door open when the lady walks by and says, well, thank you. I go, yes, ma'am. And that's it. I don't need a little pat on the head. I don't need a little pinch on the cheek. It's just a little thing. Somebody told me it was like trying to do nice things for people and not get caught. It's like stealing in reverse. And I do that today. And that's how I make amends for the scumbag I was. Is by living in a non-scumbag way. Prayer and meditation became an active part of my life. A lot of people say they had this God-shaped hole in their lives. Mine wasn't really a God-shaped hole. I always joke that it was more the shape of a mandala, but, you know, that's just my own thing. Addiction is a disease of obsession and compulsion. Obsession is the mental part of it, and compulsion is the physical inability to stop. Prayer and meditation is a mental and a physical. And I had one of those V8 moments sitting in a meeting one night. And I said, what if the 11th step is the antidote to addiction? Because with the 11th step, if I have a mental and a physical process that counteracts obsession and compulsion, that's what helps me stay clean. Meditation, prayer and meditation has been a daily part of my life. I'm not perfect with it. It has taken me places. When I said my disease can manifest in any area of my life, it's true. When I first started into the process of meditation, I enjoyed it because it was that quieting the mind. One of the things I miss, and I always forget to say it because I don't think about using like this as much anymore, I was never someone that enjoyed getting high. It was never about getting high to me. Because of this battle, this mental thing going on in my head, the duality, the different life styles and things I had going on, for me, using was about turning it off. And that's why I did the kind of drugs I did, was so that I could get off and get out quickly. I didn't want to be the guy running around, having a great time, painting the garage at 1:30 in the morning. I was the guy that wanted to sit and drool on the couch. You just didn't understand what it was like to lay on the floor with no clothes on, you know? When I started in the process of meditation, my disease manifested in meditation. What started out is I hear people say I can't quiet my mind for 5 seconds or for 30 seconds. And I had to apply it. I had to get into that. 5 seconds turns into 30, turns into 60. Turns into 5 minutes. Turns into 20 minutes a day. Starting to read about other meditators, other people who really know about meditation, other types of meditation. All the different gods have meditation practices. It's kind of interesting to see the things they all have in common. My meditation practice got to the point where my wife left one afternoon to go to Raleigh, which was about 2.5 hours away, to take the kids, the grandchildren at that point, to a film. And came back. I was in the same position I was in when she left. So the disease of addiction can manifest in good things too. I found myself hiding in that realm. I had to understand that I couldn't just keep it myself. I had to go outside of myself. I had to give back. I got involved in H&I. I got involved in a lot of different service forms. One of the things that has defined my recovery has been service. And when I was first clean, I met a man who gave a history workshop in Greensboro, North Carolina. I had maybe 3 or 4 months clean. And we sat down and we started talking. and he was this jolly little fellow, kind of looked like Jerry Garcia. And he understood where I'd been and where I'd come from. And he turned to me and he asked me, he said, do me a favor. Just please don't listen to a speaker tape of me. I said, well, that's kind of an odd request. I said, all right, why? He said, just don't. And so I didn't. And we became friends. And I'd go to conventions and I'd see him and people would stand in line to talk to him. I was like, this is my friend. And we'd talk on the phone. And he taught me about the fact that the things that matter in our program are our program and our history. We have to learn from our mistakes so that the addict who hasn't walked in the door yet has a room to come to. And that's why our history was so important to us. It was because as dope fiends, A, we want to change the history to make us feel better, and B, we always have a new idea. And we don't want to look back at the past to see what has already failed. He made me own the experience I had before I got clean. He made me own the responsibility of carrying a message. He taught me about common welfare and our traditions. He taught me about the things that unite us. He told me about relationships. When you go to a regular Narcotics Anonymous convention, a lot of times there's a relationships and recovery workshop. There's 600 people in the meeting. And you go next door, and at the exact same time, there's a 12 traditions workshop, and there's 7 people in the room. And I don't go, and I'm not going to go through all 12 traditions or anything, but the concept that he taught me was the common welfare we needed to deal with, how our common welfare mattered in our recovery and our history. As long as I focus on the things we have in common, I'm okay. My recovery works. That's why we don't talk about the dope. That's why we don't identify our higher powers. That's why we use the word addict. Because the same disease of addiction that a guy who sits under a bridge and shoots dope has is the same disease of addiction that a sweet little grandmother who goes to 5 different doctors because her hip hurts. If she were to sit in a meeting and talk about driving the Bentley to 5 different doctors, the guy who's sitting under the bridge isn't going to understand that. Fear, desperation, uncontrollable compulsion. They understand that with each other. That's why the language we use is designed that way. No one's paying to sit here. We come freely. One of the great lines from the Gray Form is, you know, we come from apartments, houses, places and bridges. The concepts that I have learned to live by with the steps and the traditions taught me that the relationships that I have are important, and how I learned to relate with everybody in the rooms is important. And he told me that, you know, I needed to have 5 relationships in my life. And anybody tell you when you're first new that you shouldn't have any relationships for a year? Anyone? Bueller? Okay. You do. You need 5 of them. And none of them have to do with sex. Sorry. And he said, you know, the first relationship I had to have was a relationship with self. He called it honesty. Don't lie, cheat, or steal. Again, I'm the one who lays with my head on the pillow at the end of the night. The second relationship I had to have was with a sponsor. I had to learn to trust someone. Anybody ever gone on that sponsor hunt, trying to find that perfect sponsor? Anyone? Okay. You're never going to find the perfect sponsor. There is no way that anybody else can screw your life up any more than you already have. And your sponsor's not going to be prejudiced against you the way that you already are against yourself. I had to have a relationship with others in the rooms. I called it fellowship. The fourth relationship was a relationship with the higher power, spirituality. And the last one was integrity. strict adherence to a moral code. It means live this way. There are certain pet peeves and things that we talk about in the rooms. Certain things that have changed over the course of time. Meeting etiquette. We are responsible for this. There is an atmosphere of us and them that is developing in our rooms. Some people fall in on the us realm. Some people fall in on the them realm. I'm going to war with the us and them. Only together can we solve this. Alone, I cannot do this. Recently, we had a big issue with a movement with regards to our service structure. And I had the audacity to stand at a podium and say, I've done service at the area and home group level, area level, regional level, and world level. And I had the audacity to stand there and turn to someone who had been clean for 25 years and say, you haven't chaired a meeting in 25 years. Who are you to lecture me about what we've done with this program since you left? Since you left it in our hands. And I said, let's look at this. When someone comes into the Alcoholics Anonymous program, in 30 days' time, they know who Bill Wilson is. They know about the Alcoholics Anonymous literature. They know how their steps work. And they know about their history. Someone comes into Narcotics Anonymous. In 30 days' time, they know who's fucking who. They know who's dirty in the rooms and who's got a little business going on the side. And they know who they can get over on. If that stings, it's supposed to. We did not inherit this program from Jimmy Kinnon and Jack Whaley and Greg Pierce. We are borrowing this program from the addict who has not even walked through the door yet. And this is preaching to the choir, because those of us that are here probably have a very similar view to that. But our responsibility level and how I get hardened in meetings. I can't always lead by example. I can't turn to someone. I went to a meeting in Knoxville, Tennessee recently when we moved there. It's a candlelight meeting. And I'm sitting in the meeting, and there's five or six people in a candlelight meeting texting to each other. Each other in the meeting. I get a young man who sits down next to me and he says, and I mean, he's texting, right? It's a freaking clicky thing. And I put my hand up and I said, hey, could you do that just somewhere else? And he says, look, if you can't deal with it, maybe you need to focus more on the message than what's happening around you. Okay, camper. All right, Sparky. And I asked him if I could step outside with him. And I said, how about you call your sponsor and you tell your sponsor that a guy with 20-plus years just told you that you needed to focus on talking to your sponsor about the fact that you couldn't sit in a 60-minute meeting without having to get up, have a cup of coffee, make two trips to the bathroom, and spend the rest of the time on the phone. If you have the balls to do that and you want to come back and talk to me, I'll be standing right here. Well, his sponsor came up to see me at a meeting the next day and thanked me. He told me that he had left his phone in the car that day. Sometimes we need a spiritual awakening. Sometimes we need a rude awakening. Dutch taught me that I can probably be that rude awakening. I'm not the one to sit and pat someone on the ass and say, that's okay, the important thing is that you're back when you come back from a relapse. That's not me. Relapse is not okay. Sorry. Relapse is not okay. Don't do that anymore. I'm glad you're back. I really am. But here's the problem with relapse. Again, I'm a smart guy. When I see some dumb son of a bitch, really, and I mean dumb son of a bitch, go out, get loaded 7 times, and come back in with no consequences, I start thinking to myself, I could do that. I'm smart. I could go out and get loaded.
I won't have a problem getting back here.
And it creates a doubt in my mind. And I got to put work into that. If I don't say something, I'd rather have someone sit in a meeting pissed off because I said something, angry, than not say something and have them go back out again and die. And it's hard. We struggle with this stuff, the meeting etiquette. You know, you sit in a meeting. Meeting is from the time we pray until the time we pray. Period. We're here for an hour, our common welfare. What is our common welfare? You know, the relationships I have. That common welfare doesn't just apply here in the rooms, you know? When I look at all the problems I have in my life, anytime I have a problem, all I have to look at is what part have I played in it. You know, my relationship with my bank teller is very, very simple. I give her a deposit slip and a check, and she puts money in my account. She doesn't need to know how my car is running. She doesn't need to know I took the Sixers, which I never do. All she needs to know about is this is my deposit slip and this is my check. That's all she needs to know. If I look down and I notice she has a coffee cup on her desk, I'm in the coffee business. That's what I do for a living. That's one other area of common welfare. But as long as I don't stray from that, that relationship is okay. There's a lot of issues we're dealing with. A lot of things that are creating an us and them environment in our rooms. I got involved in our literature process very early on because I wrote literature in the other program. As a kid, I was good at it. I enjoyed it. I like putting words together. I'm not embarrassed about the fact that I've managed to experience putting my eyes on paper and remembering it anymore. It's okay. But when I beat someone with it, that's where it becomes a problem. And I can do that. And I still do that. That's why it's a constant process. This is a recovery process. You know, we managed to do something in this program that we've never done before. You know, in all the history of any recovery of any form, any sort of therapeutic community, we wrote a book. We wrote this book. And I have no fears. In my views, this is the last book we wrote. And that's not an us and them thing. I've participated in the process at the world level for 20 years. And it has changed. So there's a big issue going on right now with, you know, our literature is being sold in other places, in Amazon.com. Our literature is sold in Walmart. Oh my God. The arguments going on about it being sold in Walmart. The us and thems are fighting. I got on that bandwagon myself. And then it hit me. What if somebody walks into Walmart one day, a dope fiend, an active dope fiend? Because, you know, it's possible because, you know, that's kind of one of the places that we went. And what if they pick up a basic text in Narcotics Anonymous and they read something that saves their life and brings them here? If that happens to one person, is it worth it? We have a responsibility. We all have this great love for all of our predecessors. I do too. But our predecessors would have this point of view, which is there is no us and them. Because when we start making us and them, we start forgetting about the fact that I cannot do it alone, but you cannot do it for me. We have to do it together. Jimmy would not be having these arguments. Greg would not be having these arguments. These are our realities today. This is our responsibility. This is the faithful. We carry a tremendous responsibility. I would have been so upset if this was a filled room. I really would have been, because it would have told me that there's more people out there trying to do this and failing. I don't know if it's a call to arms or whatever it is, but it's a real sense of responsibility that we do have here. If we understand this stuff, we have to talk about it. We have to say it, regardless of whether we feel as though it's going to hurt someone's feelings. If you feel as though it's going to help them stay clean, it's your responsibility to say up, stand up and say something.
I'll say two more things. You know, we wrote this book, and you'll hear a lot more about how we wrote this book and everything else. But it has to mean something to us. We finished this, and we printed it into this. They used to say it works on the cover. First edition. Now, we have museum-quality stuff, which is really fortunate. You know, my friend Danny brings a multitude of things, a wealth of information, as does Boyd and Chris. You know, the man who gave me this book went back out. And at 17 or 18 years, when he gave me the book, because we were working in the sixth edition at the time, and I was trying to have a copy of everything to look from, when he went back out, he said, "You'll take it to people. You speak a lot. Have people touch it. This is our history. This is your history. You know, some of you folks that are young and new, come touch it. Read it. Flip through it. Yeah, there's a few phrases and things on it. You know, but it's not a museum piece. It's not something that we protect like that. And there are some things that have to be protected because we have to keep them. But I want you to touch it. It's the first edition. We had some issues, so we had a second one of those. Touch this one. Then the program got back involved, and then we had another conference. We have a third one. Then we really fucked it up. We made a third edition revised because we couldn't count. Then we had to have a fourth edition, simply because there needed to be some place to stick a sticker. Then most people got clean on a fifth edition basic text. That book comes from Marion Correctional Institution. Up until the time that I moved to Knoxville about a year ago, I used to go every Monday night. This is a maximum security administrative segregation prison. These are the guys that don't do well in regular maximum security. Okay? This was their library book. When I went to the area and I said, when we moved in there about 5 or 6 years ago, I said, why doesn't anybody go in to Marion Correction? And they said, well, first of all, nobody can get in. And secondly, we weren't getting the desired effect when we could. And I never quite understood that, what the desired effect was. So when the fifth edition came out, they put one in there, and it had basically not been opened in all the years it had been there, because the inmates can't have a hardcover book. We have, and our history tells us, ideas. And we learn from those mistakes. Couldn't get a hardcover book into a prison. So there's a man named Lou Poppin, and I can use Lou's name because he's dead now. And Lou was a guy who had great ideas, and he had a lot of money, and he was so grateful to be clean. And he was a really cool, nice man. He lived in Miami at the time, actually, Chesapeake, Potomac, and then he moved to Miami. And he had this great idea, and they kept going to World Service, and they said, hey, let's do a basic text that we can take into prisons. And he said, well, we can't really do that. We have to work on it. It's a committee. The same stuff you always think you hear. So he had this brilliant idea. Let's make plates, and let's print basic texts. First 10 chapters, he found out that they could print them for about 45 cents a piece. You've seen dozens of these out there. That first set, this is one of those. This went into the Miami-Dade Correctional Facility. There are people that are clean today because Lou Poppin made that happen and paid for it. I didn't realize that, and we killed Lou. And I say that very seriously, and I'm glad you just raised your eyebrows. We had a major lawsuit that happened, and everybody here can probably tell you about that. But the intellectual rights of our program came under fire. And eventually, in Philadelphia, the federal court judge basically told our board, or our lawyers from Narcotics Anonymous and the people who were in this process, that we needed to go into the hallway and make a decision because neither side wanted him to make a ruling. Very smart man. And we, the us and them, didn't like that outcome. And so things started happening. Like, Lou would come into meetings and he'd sit down at a table or at a chair, and people would get up and walk away from that chair because he was selling Narcotics Anonymous. He was profiting from it. Lou didn't need to profit. And he was shunned, and we killed him by character assassination. And eventually, Lou went out and used. The last I knew of what had happened to Lou was somebody found him in just outside of in CNP, just outside of Washington, D.C. And he was taking a little pocket knife, digging a hole in his leg and pouring the dope into his veins directly because he couldn't find a vein. Trying to get off like that. Gangrene. 15th of May, 1996, Lou died. We killed him as a fellowship. We, as a fellowship, us and them, killed Lou Poppin. I make that point because we're headed down that road. And instead of Lou Poppin being the man who we kill, it's that empty chair. That's the person us and them is going to kill. We need to be really careful and very responsible with what we know and what we understand. You know, the great Spider-Man line, with great power comes great responsibility. It's kind of like once you pull the curtain back and you actually see what's going on behind the curtain and you meet the wizard, you can't be blind anymore. There is no us and them. The people that are doing service at our lower levels of service today have been doing it for 25 years. The reason is because there's so much apathy. We are the ones who are still doing service work. We are the ones who are filling our area and our group and our regional services. We need to be the ones to teach the next generation to do the work. And that's a great responsibility, and we can't fuck it up because that empty chair is counting on it. I'm so glad I didn't walk in the rooms now. I'm so glad that I had people who taught me our history, because it matters. I'm glad I know who Jimmy Kinnon was and how our history works. And what we've done. And what we've done wrong. I don't believe in the hiding of mistakes. I also don't believe in the crucifixion of the people who make them. We are all addicts and we are all capable of falling. Because at some point we will all fall. And it's at those times, at those places, that we look inside of ourselves. And we recover or we fall. That's the responsibility we carry in these rooms. I don't want anybody else to die because we don't understand what us and them is. So that's what I would charge people to go out and look at. I asked, when Dan started doing readings, I asked him to do, to not do one thing. And I always say this when I finish up anything at a podium. My folks, you know, when my dad died 12 years ago, nobody had a bad thing to say about him, not even me. He came to appreciate my recovery. My father, through physically, got to a point where he couldn't drink anymore, and we actually did come to terms. And I think we had a good relationship at the end, you know, different generations. But I used to visit them in Jersey from North Carolina, and I'd go back to New York City. And there used to be a great meeting, and there still is, but there was a great meeting at the corner of 2nd and St. Mark's. It was called Midnight Miracle. in a burned out church. And I went on a Thanksgiving night to Midnight Miracle. And it's a podium meeting. You'd come and you'd stand up at the podium. The chairperson would recognize you. And there was a man standing over in the corner in trench coat. And you could tell he had been from the street. And it was getting near the end of the meeting, and the chairperson recognized him. And he said, "All right, man, come on up here." And during the meeting originally, people were great. And I whenever I go to gratitude meet or go to meetings and the topic is gratitude, I always say I'm really grateful. It's been a long time since I've been in a gratitude meeting. Because gratitude is something we do. It's not something we say. And there's people up there thankful and grateful for their house in the Hamptons and their apartments and their cars. The guy was grateful for his Porsche. And it was, the whole thing was just about the money, property, and prestige. And this guy stands up and he raises his hand and he got and came up to the top and he said, "You know, I don't have a house in the Hamptons and I don't have a Porsche. I don't have a driver's license." And he says, "But you know what I got? I got this shirt. And I need to talk about this shirt first before I finish this. How many people found Narcotics Anonymous in an institution of some form? Okay. How many people found it through some way of public information, a billboard, calling a hotline, something? Okay. Has anybody ever been walking downtown in a nice town, nice hotel somewhere, go inside, maybe find a little hot water, take care of a little business, and they just happen to be having an NA convention, and you walked in, they smothered you, and you've been clean ever since? Anyone? No one? Okay, I've been asking that question for 22 years, and I've never had anybody answer that. If you raised your hand for one way or the other, that's where you serve. It's like a litmus test. The answers are there for you. I took an inmate that's my age out of a maximum security prison out of a medium and then a minimum security prison 3 nights a week for 3 years. And the very first time he was able to spend a holiday out from behind the walls, he came to our house and sat there with his hands in his pocket. My wife pulled his hands out of his pockets, said, "You can relax." And he had smuggled this shirt out. And kind of funny, and 15 years later it still fits me, but it was a standard North Carolina Department of Corrections standard issue. He had smuggled gold paint into a prison and had one of the guys who was an artist hand paint service through H&I. And he smuggled it out. So when I speak, I wire it. To honor him, because that was what it was. It was an honor. And he's still clean today. He called me this evening. He wanted to know if I was going to be in Winston, because I usually do a business event this weekend. You know? So, I go back to the guy who was standing at St. Mark's. He says, "You know, I got this NA t-shirt. It's an H&I thing I got. You know, I got my coat down at the shelter, and they're going to let me in afterwards, because I sweep up." He says, "I got this book." He held up a basic text. He says, "You know, I really don't know about this house in the Hamptons. I don't know about these Porsches. So, but I know about this." And he read, "When at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative, either go on as best we can, the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death. Face a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, not spiritual program known as Narcotics Anonymous." And the bottom fell out. And I remember that. And I try to on a daily basis. It's been a good day to be clean, and I thank you all for being here.